My name's Silky Whitworth. I work in a joint unit between Department for Business and the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government. Thank you very much for inviting me this evening to chair this event. This is the first in a new seminar series, I believe, at the LSE, London Talks, which aims to create partnerships with significant London stakeholders and show how research and practice in London can link to cities across the world. So, in terms of how this evening will work, we've got two presentations this evening to go through. The first from Neil Lee, who I know many of you know well. He's a professor of economic geography and associate professor of economic geography. I know these titles are important at the LSE. And he'll be talking a bit about his work, his most recent work on inclusive growth. And then I'll hand over to Alex Jan, who's the director of AREP's City Economics Team. An economist by training and an LSE alumnus, I believe. It will be talking about AREP's recent work looking at the future of the West End in London. So before I launch into those presentations, I thought I'd give a few thoughts from the government perspective, if you'd let me sort of indulge my position as chair here. So we'll be hearing from academia and the private sector, but the part of government that I work in the Cities and Local Growth Unit, is responsible for rolling out local industrial strategies across England. Can you just raise your hand if you've heard of them? Okay, that's not bad, actually. Okay, good. So for those of you that don't know, they were announced in the government's white paper on industrial strategy. They will be rolled out in all 38 local economic partnership regions across England, and their aim is to boost productivity in every part of the country, whilst also ensuring that all communities in these places can contribute to and benefit from prosperity. That's really hard, isn't it? Because we don't really know what that means. But we're starting to learn on the job by working with different parts of the country, and of course London is one of the places that we're working with. Now, my unit in government is also there to support the Minister for London, who has to work with the GLA, of course, and the Mayor of London. And so, as an official, there's all sorts of layers of politics that we have to think about when we're advising our ministers on how best to deliver things like local industrial strategies. And so I thought there were three levels that we might consider this evening and come back to in our debate this evening when we're thinking about what should growth look like in London. One is thinking about London as a global city with humanity as the beneficiaries of growth. So London is influential at a global scale. Of course, the world is urbanising, and could it grow in a green way that influences others on how to benefit, how to couple urbanisation in a sustainable way with fighting climate change? It's also one of the top performers in the OECD on innovation, of course, and how might London seize that at a global scale, so with growth benefiting humanity in the long term. Second, we might want to consider London, as our capital, a net contributor, a redistributor around the country, with the UK therefore being the beneficiary. London takes home about a third of the national tax take. It's home to the brightest and the best. Many of you, of course, I'm sure, live within the city. And generally speaking, when London does well, so does the rest of the country. But, of course, we have a government that's interested in other parts of the country as well, and there is a very live debate about a zero-sum game and whether if we want to invest in the north and other parts of the country, that will detract from London and so on, and I'm sure we'll get into that this evening. And finally, if we consider London in isolation and the local groups that live within it as beneficiaries, then we start to really think about the considerable wealth, income and social inequalities in the city. The poorest 50% of Londoners own just 4% of the land, and there are plenty of other stats that I could illustrate the point with. Does that mean that ministers should pull away from the shiny, innovative opportunities in the city towards and tilt towards inclusive policies? And are they mutually exclusive? Of course, they're not. But in a certain spending envelope, you have to make some choices. So perhaps at the end of these presentations and after some debate with yourselves, I'd like to bring us back to the question, what should I do when I have to advise the Minister for London on what sort of growth we want for the city, and how does he have that conversation with the Mayor of London? So think about that for the next half an hour. I'll hand over to Neil, who's going to talk a bit now about inclusive growth.
Thank you. That's an interesting question, and one I should have a better answer for, I'll be honest, because I'm not going to be particularly helpful. Well, first of all, I should say it's really nice to be invited to speak to something in my own university. It's kind of like a home match, a home fixture. So like Tottenham last night, I will look to spoil my home advantage. We're in the Alumni Lecture Theatre, and because there are so many future alumni in here, I should say that this is funded by our alumni. And isn't it beautiful? And wouldn't you like to have a lecture theatre like this named after you in future as well? So I'm going to be unhelpful. I'm going to talk a little bit about the sort of growth we should be aiming for in London, with this sort of caveat that actually sort of, you know, normally I would regard myself as a London expert, but in the context of some of the people we have in the room, people like Professor Ian Gordon, who sort of lectured me on London, first got me sort of interested in the city, actually I'm probably not the best placed person to talk about the city. But it is pretty clear, and I think we can probably all share the diagnosis of the problem we face in London. And it's very clear what the problem hasn't been, at least until, you know, maybe November. It was going to be March, now it's going to be November, when sort of growth might start being a problem. But the one thing we can say is that London's growth performance has been pretty good over the last, pretty good, maybe even sort of stellar, over the last sort of 15, 20 years. And I'm just about old enough to remember when London really wasn't sort of quite such a nice place to live as it is now. So this is from GLA, you know, looking at the longer term growth in employment and gross value added. For those of you who aren't complete geeks like me, you'll know that gross value, or you won't know that gross value added is sort of similar to a sort of subnational version of GDP. And what we can see here is that employment growth in the 70s up until 1991, London lagged Great Britain. It lagged Great Britain in terms of gross value added, but something happened in the sort of end of the 80s, start of the 1990s, and London really started to outpace the rest of the country. So in some ways, London's a sort of really, really good news story there. But of course, the problem here is that growth really hasn't dented poverty. You know, so this is, your apologies, this is, so London before housing costs is the blue bar, London after housing costs is the sort of orange bar, and what you can see is that there's been some change. You know, there's a little bit of sort of cyclical change with the sort of economy, some changes due to sort of benefits reforms, so on. But actually, looking at poverty in London really hasn't shifted, you know, not as much as you would expect, particularly given that London's growth performance has been so stellar, particularly in those sort of, you know, compared to the rest of the country. So what we've seen is this problem, which I think is probably familiar to anyone here, that what we've seen is London's growth really hasn't trickled down. It hasn't reached down to the people who are sort of most disadvantaged, whether those people are Londoners or incomers from other places. So I think we're sort of reasonably clear on the problem. And, you know, I would go so far as to say that, you know, you can see this problem is well recognised by people like the Mayor of London. So this is the draft economic development strategy. I really have to confess that I haven't read this. And I'm really, it's about 200 pages long. And there's lots of other people who have read the draft economic development strategy, and even the economic development strategy, but you can see this sort of concept is sort of well located in these, you know, some people may even have written it. But you can see that this sort of concept is clear. I mean, I think the diagnosis is pretty clear, that basically we have this rich city, and despite the economic strength, the city is home to some of the poorest neighbourhoods and some of the poorest people in the country. Almost 3 in 10 Londoners today live in poverty, and that figure really hasn't changed as much as we would like. Now, there's something interesting about this quote. There's a reason for using this quote, which is that they talk about poverty and disadvantage in London not just as being the consequence of growth, but actually holding back growth in the capital itself. And I think that's quite an interesting argument, and I'll come on to that a little bit later. So, hopefully, the area of sort of common agreement is the problem. I think it's useful to think a little bit about what the solution might be. Now, there are all sorts of, you know, there's all sorts of sort of, I haven't read every single sort of London policy document, but one of the key things which we've seen as I go in and talk to people in the GLA is this sort of interest in the idea of making an inclusive economy, the idea of sort of inclusive growth. And this is a concept which has been enormously popular right across the UK, and it has sort of really become popular, well, and it's become very, very popular in the GLA as well. So I want to say a little bit about inclusive growth, this concept, why it has become important, and what the sort of problems of this concept might be, inclusive growth or inclusive economy. And this is Google Trends data. So basically what this shows you is going back to 2004, going up to, you know, actually I did this last night, going up to last night, you can see that the, you know, this is the level of interest, the number of people who are searching for the term inclusive growth. Now, what you can see is 2004, no one was sort of particularly interested in this. There was a little bit of interest in the late 2000s, but certainly in the UK, there's been a lot of interest in the term inclusive growth. It's sort of mushroomed as a concept. There's been some very high-profile research institutes, the Inclusive Growth Analysis Unit at the University of Manchester, for example, set up to look into this trend. And it's important, and it's sort of reflected in some of these sort of policy documents we see coming out of the Mayor of London. This spike here is when my paper was released on, not that spike, the spike to the left, the spike to the right of the big one. But you can see that there was a, you know, there's been lots of interest, not least because of the Royal Society of the Arts published a very, very important piece. That spike there is probably actually my students sort of Googling inclusive growth to find out what it is after my lectures. So, what is inclusive growth? And this is really the sort of crux of the issue here, right? Which is that actually inclusive growth sounds like a sort of simple concept. It sounds like something which is going to be really nice for a city like London to adopt, but actually it's considerably more complicated than that. So you might sort of say inclusive growth is somewhere in the middle of this Venn diagram, where growth and inclusion meet. So policies you can put in place which serve those two goals. And this is the sort of purist way of thinking about inclusive growth. There's all sorts of other concepts. I mean, so Ruth Lupton, Kerry Hughes, you know, they talk about inclusive growth sometimes being this sort of idea that if you do something about poverty and disadvantage, that can somehow propel your sort of local economy. So there's sort of other sort of conceptions there. But the problem with the solution is that really nobody knows what it means. So to a certain degree, it reflects a sort of a Rorschach test. So Rorschach test, an inkblot test, which you, when you go to a psychiatrist, I'm told, they will give you a Rorschach test, and you sort of, this is an ink blot test where you look at it and everyone projects what they think onto that sort of ink blot. So I'm thinking, in 50 minutes we can go to the George, and this looks like a pint to me. So this is the sort of thing which you'd sort of think about. And I think inclusive growth is really, really interesting because basically it sort of fulfills this agenda, you know, it's one of these things where everyone can project their own interests and their own thinking onto it. And this is slightly problematic to use it as a policy tool because it means that, you know, we have lots of different people talking about the same concept and they talk about that concept. What they're talking about is actually very, very different things. Now, sort of as an academic, I'm obliged to include a few sort of quotes and sort of references. And inclusive growth for me is really like one of my favourite papers by Anne Markison, where she talks about the idea of fuzzy concepts. These are things which are poorly defined. They are defined differently to different people, and because of that, it makes them difficult to use for policy. And you can see this in the academic debates about inclusive growth. Some people, you know, I focus on labour markets. I'm mostly interested in labour markets. As a sort of Ian Gordon protege, I think they're really, really sort of important. Whereas actually, you know, I think inclusive growth should all be about labour markets. But for other people, for some, you know, people who work on health, they think inclusive growth should all be about health. Or all be about the third sector, or all be about something else. And this is problematic when we start sort of using it for policy, because we really don't know what it means, even in a sort of city sort of such as London. So it becomes a sort of fuzzy, fuzzy concept. So that's my first critique of inclusive growth, and the reason why inclusive growth probably is going to be difficult. It might serve part of the role in sort of addressing this problem I've identified, but it's, you know, there are problems with this solution. Now, second problem is that it's very hard to know how you do it. And there's been some sort of valiant efforts to try and operationalize the concept of inclusive growth. But I would argue, so I'm sort of loosely affiliated with something called the What Works Centre for Local Economic Growth. The What Works Centre for Local Economic Growth is essentially a body which tries to evaluate the evidence base behind many sort of local economic development policies. Now, this has been controversial because, you know, they tend to rate stuff as not working very well. Or, you know, they tend to have such a high standard of evidence that it's very hard to know, you know, whether we should be trusting the small number of samples they let through the net. But the thing about the What Works Centre for Local Economic Growth is that generally it's sort of done a good job of showing that actually sometimes we don't know what works in local economic growth. And I would argue that when you sort of, you know, add an additional leap here and start thinking about what works for local inclusive growth, things are even slightly tougher, because inclusive growth is conceptually fuzzy. We have far less of an evidence base on it. There's no consistent definitions. So if we don't know how to drive growth in a local area, then it's very hard to know how you might drive inclusive growth in that same local area. So those are my sort of, you know, first two sort of, you know, critiques. It's fuzzy. We don't really know how to do it. But I guess, you know, my next sort of point here would be that actually it's not clear that local government has the powers they need to do anything about it. So this is a little bit dated. I think things have changed a little bit since then. But this is from a piece by Tony Travers, where he sets out the different things, policy areas which are held at different layers of levels of government. And I like this because it very clearly shows that the big sticks you have in terms of sort of addressing poverty and inequality, the big sticks in a country like the UK, these are all held by the national government. It's things like the taxation system. It's things like, you know, things around, you know, social security, the benefit system, all of these things, the really important levers, these tend to be held by national government. So it's a bit of a stretch to say that, you know, we've got this fuzzy concept, we don't really know how to do it, and even if we did know how to do it, of course, it would be very difficult for the GLA to do anything about it, because they've got some powers, and I don't want to say that they can do nothing at all, but it's very difficult for them to sort of achieve, I guess, the big changes. And my fourth critique here is that, and I was looking for a way to illustrate this graphically, and I'm not sure it works, but this is a Chinese robot unicorn. And I like this because I think Chinese robot unicorns illustrate the sort of three things, the three parts of the point I'm trying to make here, which is that there have been big, big changes in the economies of cities like London. Lots of that has been driven by trade, hence China. Lots of that has been driven by technology, hence a robot. And the point here is that we have these really big forces shaping the economy of a city like London. Big forces around technological change, big forces around global trade. And of course, to then think that we can somehow shape the economy strikes me as sort of unicorn-type thinking. You know, it's a magical creature which doesn't necessarily exist. And of course, I don't mean to say that we can do nothing. I just mean to say that we have to be cautious and we have to be a little bit careful about what exactly we can do here. Yeah, because there is something of the sort of unicorn thinking. So, what I've tried to do is set this up by saying that, you know, it's a fuzzy concept, erratically defined, we don't really know how to do it. Even if we did know how to do it, local areas don't necessarily have the powers to do it, and they're fighting against big, big, powerful forces of technological change and globalization, which are shaping our economies. So it's going to be hard for them to do anything at all. But I don't want to think that inclusive growth is a completely useless concept or that the Mayor of London can do nothing at all. I want to critique it, but also I want to give something of a defence. And because while it's hard to achieve, while local government doesn't have many powers, it can still change some things. And I think Alex's presentation is going to suggest some of the ways in which inclusive growth might be achieved. And even if this sort of focus on an inclusive economy or, you know, poverty reduction through growth, or however it gets framed at a sort of local level, even if this doesn't change much, it can still change something. There are lots of services which can be bent to sort of affect people, you know, to shape the distribution of income. So it is, you know, it is important from that perspective. And it's also important because it's an overdue recognition that at least we can think a little bit about the distributional consequences of urban growth, because we are certainly doing something, and local government, while it cannot completely shape patterns of sort of inequality and poverty in a city, it can at least do something. So I'll just leave on my final point, which is that inclusive growth, while it's not perfect, it's certainly better than nothing. Okay, thank you.
Sorry, I should have got up in a tune, isn't it? about, as Neil said, bringing this to life a little bit in the West End. I think he'll talk for about 15 minutes and then I'll open up for some debate.
Okay, thank you, Silky. Good evening, everybody. Nice to see familiar faces on the London Circus. I'm going to try and talk about some work we did with the GLA and actually Westminster, who came on board late last year to do with the good growth. I apologise for the fact we're using these terms because, as Neil's already said, they mean different things to different people and they're all subject to faddism to a certain extent, inclusive growth, sustainable growth, and now good growth. But aiming off of that, I think hopefully I can take you on a bit of a journey or a story which actually tries to define in value judgment but objective terms, if that's allowed, what some of these things mean in the world of the West End, and then what sort of policy responses might produce better outcomes, shall we say, rather than worse outcomes over the future. There's a 125-page report sitting behind this, so I apologise in advance for the fact that I'm only going to be able to skim through. Silky's already mentioned 15 minutes, so I'm going to do my best not to, to crowd out the time for discussion, but we can come back to certain things if you want to. So very briefly, the work, as I say, was commissioned by the GLA, and I think that in the sort of in the aftermath of the Oxford Street spat, there was a desire in City Hall to try and understand what, you know, how is the West End going to develop, and how can policies, interventions be evaluated at various levels of government in the West End and elsewhere by City Hall in order to be supportive or otherwise of policy. And I think the really positive thing was that actually Westminster came on board with this study, so there was close working at an officer level on the project, and I think that actually has helped us to produce a better report overall. I think can't go without saying the huge importance of the advent of Crossrail 1, potentially Crossrail 2, but as you'll see, we see Crossrail 1 and anchoring its potential to deliver employment growth in the West End as actually an incredibly important component of what we would define as good growth. We can explore that. The other thing is that, as you know, retail is going through major change. The whole click and collect, you know, versus bricks, clicks versus bricks issue, which is a threat to many high streets, if not the West End as such, you know. So what needs to be done to respond to that? And I think, you know, easy to forget, given how little national coverage it gets, but the huge importance of this area. I mean, one in five Londoners work in the West End. It's about 4% of UK GVA, GDP. I mean, if Tony Travers was here, he would remind us that fishing is about 5,000 people and 0.12% of GDP. I mean, you get the point about, you know, the enormous significance of this area. And of course, many people who work there don't live there. And many of them are from perhaps some of the groups that Neil's identified in terms of the lower income jobs and so forth. The other thing that's really interesting is that employment has been growing despite the fact that floor space and vacancy rates have been falling. So despite the fact that floor space has been falling, employment has been growing. And that's, again, a crucial component of our trying to understand what will happen next. And some really interesting trends in that, and indeed use of transport, which we may or may not get onto today. The other thing is the importance of this area is from an arts, culture and entertainment point of view. You can see where we're going with the good growth agenda, can't you? It has strong residential functions, around 50,000 residents there. 500,000 people work there. You know, there. What would happen if the West End faltered? What would that do to the good growth narrative of London, and indeed to the economic contribution that London makes? As we know, big fiscal transfers that have been mentioned, around £3,500 for every man, woman, and child in London leaves. I'd like to see them sort of leave in Brinks Mat vans on a Friday evening across the M25. As they go to the rest of the country. And then the other issue is this hugely important impact on TfL finances if the West End doesn't grow and prosper. And those of you who saw the news have seen Moody's latest note, which shows that the delay to Crossrail has a gross revenue impact on TfL of around £1 billion. That's serious money. And again, I think, as you'll see when we get into the good growth agenda, an impact on TfL's finances, which is positive, I think could be regarded as good. and one which was negative could be regarded as bad. So I've done half the report now in the first slide, which is great. So I will whiz through because of time. In terms of just spatial definition, when we talk about, when I talk about sort of the West End, or we talk about the whole West End, it's the blue line to, we actually go beyond Westminster's boundaries up to Russell Square, along the sort of the Euston Road, down Park Lane and Edgware Road, and then we cut across the bottom towards the river. And then in our modelling work, what we looked at was these concepts of core West End, which is the blue line, the deep blue line, the Oxford Street district, and then the Oxford Street district with Soho. So that's the attempt, because we're really, the GLA's primary concern was around Oxford Street and the future of retail, but we thought it's very important to look at the West End as a whole to understand some of these issues. In terms of the modelling approach that we took, we drew on what we were given our targets, in a way, in terms of good growth from the GLA and elsewhere, the Draft London Plan, the economic strategy and so forth. There's work that's been done through the West End Partnership Board on the sort of the good growth vision for the West End. We did quite a lot of baselining, best that we could, in terms of understanding the economy. We had some stakeholder engagement, some trend analysis. We looked internationally at what makes retail centres successful elsewhere. Then we developed our scenarios, then our modelling, and then some results. This is a very well-worn territory, by the way. The West End, I mean, I did my first job on the West End in about 1994 when I was at KPMG for my sins, and there must have been at least half a dozen studies on the future of the West End since then, and I've only probably been involved in three, so blame me for not getting it right. A few snapshots and statistics just reflecting the economic importance of this area. Look at how Westminster's GVA has grown compared to 1997 in nominal terms. Big increase in output. Similar sorts of increases in the city, Camden, Kensington, Chelsea, and others behind. Employment, remarkable increase in employment, as you'll see in a minute. Westminster's managed to secure an increase in employment at the same rate as London as a whole, at a time when, I'm just going to whiz through because I think I've covered some of these things, let me come back to it. Yeah, at a time when it's actually seen a fall in office space. So it's achieved a 25% increase in employment at a time when it's seen a reduction in office space. Whereas in Tower Hamlets, for example, enormous increase in floor space, and indeed a big increase in employment as well. I'll just whiz back, if I may. And I think that gives us, you'll see when we come to our scenario development, that actually we see that trend as potentially being unsustainable, because there's only so much densification of employment that can go on before the product, to use the language, becomes unattractive. And therefore, we saw a good growth scenario as one being where, if you're going to take advantage of Crossrail, then actually you need to see some increase in commercial floor space too. In terms of sort of talking to stakeholders, partly desk-based, partly in terms of interviews, this issue of London heading east, which been here many times when that's been talked about, and it's kind of talked about as a good thing, and it is a good thing in many ways, but actually if the West End doesn't respond to that, the risk is it will, through growth, then the risk is that the West End will suffer, and we'll see, and that will take the form of things like pricing out of many of the things which residents and others say give the West End its character and attractiveness. I think the other thing that came through was this desire for more flexible planning policy. Now, you're always going to get a certain amount of this, particularly from the development community, but if you look at the way retail is having to reinvent itself, and you look at the policy framework for the way in which retail is controlled by planning, I think everybody recognises the need for flexibility there, because in order for the retail product to be attractive, you've now got to have things going on in retail space, which before wasn't the case in terms of bars, alcohol consumption, activities and so forth. So I think everybody recognises that. There's something around resi development not prejudicing good growth. Some councillors were talking about the idea of putting private residential housing on Oxford Street, for example. And if you talk to the industry, they'll say the risk with that is that it sterilises buildings, it prevents redevelopment in the future. this importance of access to labour and the nighttime economy, the evening economy, the fact that, you know, another risk is this risk that intensification of employment space peters out. So the flip side of that is having sufficient growth in space to take advantage of Crossrail. This whole saga around public realm and the quality of public realm and how it complements ground floor uses and retail, and the need for it to attract more resources was widely reported by many. And then the sort of tackling the impact of good growth on residents in particular, where often they feel that they are impinged upon, their quality of life is impinged upon, because development takes place in a way which is aggravating. They can't, you know, they lose parking spaces, there's noise, there's out of hours working, all those sorts of things. And as a sort of resident of the area, I understand some of those concerns. So in terms of the sort of the Soviet view of, well, what does good growth look like? You know, tractors all produced on time in bright red. We kind of felt that these were the sort of the attributes of what good growth could look like in the area, so that the borough plan targets are met or exceeded. This rich mix that many people talk about is enhanced. There's a potential for the area to fully deliver for Londoners around as being a place of work and enjoyment and so forth. And the environment and the quality of the area is protected, and, you know, public transport and other sustainable modes are the inputs to allow the growth to take place. We did have one which said sort of generally rising asset prices. We were told by the GLA that wasn't their job to secure the destiny of the development industry, so we had to take that one out. And then in terms of this, you know, some of the other components, this strong retail destination, which is already, you know, this part of London competes internationally, so there's a need to secure that. There's something around an increased number of resi units with varied mix and tenure without prejudicing commercial development, taking advantage of Crossrail, something on the hotel offer, and ensuring the food and beverage offer also remains attractive. In terms of some of the headlines from the international case studies, we looked at Tokyo and Milan, Munich, Paris, New York. What we kind of garnered from that analysis was actually BIDs are really important, business improvement districts. Declaration of interest, I'm the chair of one of them, but we still, that was after this. This thing about retailers really investing in their space, the buildings that they own, to create exciting destination type offers. This importance of complementary offer in adjacent areas, so that, you know, you don't have a sort of sterile or monocultural type offer. A really vibrant nighttime offer. A growth in itself is a good thing for driving success, of having high and growing employment population in these locations, and actually high residential densities and residents. So what you see is that areas with residential populations tend to benefit from having residents, because they put pressure to look after these areas. Okay, I've only got 2 minutes now. So what I'm going to do is just jump to some of the results. Let me just jump to the results. Before I do that, one of the things I want to just touch on is this chart. And what this shows, because often, you know, one of the challenges we get is that the West End is full, and that the only way to provide increased growth is through building very tall buildings, which would be unacceptable in areas of residential, in areas of environmental sensitivity, and would destroy character and so forth. And what all this chart does is really show that within the West End as a whole, if you compare densities by those areas I showed you before, actually Soho has the highest employment density in land terms, of around 1,300 or so employees per hectare. Whereas for the total West End, it's about two-thirds of that. Now, of course, the West End is a mixed area. But, you know, Soho is not an area which is crammed full of Canary Wharf-style towers. So if you then said, well, what could you do, for the sake of argument, if you were to able to secure Soho levels of employment density across the West End as a whole, you could actually fit in another 320,000 jobs. to the area. So it's 500 and something at the moment, so you could increase it by 320,000. Now I know that that's not a realistic target, but what we're trying to do is illustrate in the context of all those concerns and sensitivities, what could you actually do? Okay, results, very quickly. There's a model that sits behind this, which use, and Joanna's in the room, so she can answer questions on it, the morphological method, apparently. And what this does is we took three scenarios, decline of sorts, checkered growth, which was my attempt at a pun on the checkers deal, shows you how old the work is, it's already out of date, and then a sort of good growth scenario. And the decline of sorts kind of basically said you'd see a pushback on additional office space growth in particular, and that would result in a degree of conversion from office to resi as asset prices tended to rise. You'd see a failure for retail to adapt. The sort of retail consumer market would continue to be very buyer orientated, and there'd be higher costs of doing business, not least because asset prices would rise up. And the checkered growth scenario kind of, you know, it's a bit more ambivalent, but it basically suggests that there'd be some response from retailers to online, which would be successful. The experience economy would grow a bit. In the good growth scenario, you'd have a framework in which those things happen, in which development would be encouraged, and the cost of doing business would be broadly stable. Or it might even be a bit lower. And in checkered growth, it's kind of a mix of some of those things in terms of how much would be allowed to go on. And what this shows is that in that sort of good growth scenario, we think, you know, hold that number of 300 odd thousand in your mind for the whole of the West End if it had Soho densities. We think you could probably see a growth around 100,000 in employment. Crucially, you'd see this, a big increase in business rates and GVA, and a relatively modest increase, I would argue, in floor space at around 1.3 million square metres, around 13% of the total for the West End as a whole. And I think that, to touch on some of the things Neil said, the challenge, and I will end here, the challenge is to get some of these benefits to actually not be taken out from these areas. It's to link them back in, which I think would then help with persuading people that development, which can produce lots of good outcomes, can also help to produce the mechanisms, the means to deal with the negative externalities, if you will, which make people very wary of growth often, because they just kind of see it as it's all downside. There's no upside for them, for example, as residents, because they don't see any of the benefits. I'll leave you with this factoid, really. In Holborn, around the corner, the Post building is just about to open. It's about 250,000 square feet of floor space, and it's lain empty for 20 years. It's a former post office sorting centre. We did some work which showed that if that building had been occupied in the way it's about to be today, back in year 2000, it would have generated about £64 million in business rates for Camden, if Camden had been allowed to keep the money, which of course it wouldn't be. And that's in today's prices. And I think, you know, if you imagine a world in which buildings are throwing off that sort of money, which can then be used to provide public services, schools, enforcement, improvements to the public environment, I think you're more likely to get everybody to buy into this sort of good growth type scenario. Thank you very much. I'm sorry.
Global scale as well. So I'm keen to kind of revisit those lenses
as well through some questions. I'll take three at a time and then palm them over. So would anyone like to ask questions of our speakers? Yes, lady?
Yes. I guess both of you can answer the question if you can, which I assume you can. I suppose both of you kind of touched on the vague definition, mostly Neil, the vague definition of the word or the words inclusive growth, but do you think that that could be a positive attribute given the political divergence today?
If
the word is a little bit ambiguous, then maybe two sides can see it in their own way and pass a law that has something to do with it, instead of one side, like if it's a definitively natured definition, then it becomes more difficult because two sides can be very diverse on their possibility.
Okay, and the person behind you?
Specifically to Alex, like when you were, I'm not very convinced by this SoHo thing, because presumably different kinds of jobs have different kinds of densities. Like in a restaurant kitchen, you'll have lots of people working very closely, but in high-end retail, you'll probably have people working in a big shop, but not very many of them. So, like, have you thought about that somehow, like the types of jobs involved, and is that even an appropriate metric as such? Like, maybe why are we thinking about numbers, gross numbers of jobs, as opposed to like the value added by those jobs?
I didn't really hear too much about housing. I know you really touched a lot about the labor markets. But in terms of if we're going to embrace a type of inclusive or good growth strategy, how do we account for housing, especially in the Greater London area, which is quite astronomical?
Okay, so one question there on the political lens that you look at inclusive growth through, and then one on what type of jobs are we talking about here, going back to Neil's point around the labour market and the crucial role of housing. Alex, do you want to pick up on the second two in particular, or that you've got these in the first? They're great.
I mean, on the first one, what I'd say very quickly is, I think if you break these things down into specifics and then you have a debate or an argument about the specifics, then you can kind of rebuild up what you then mean by good growth on a consensual basis. I mean, my own view is, it's quite hard to find anybody who doesn't think that Crossrail stations should be busy in central London, particularly now we build them. I mean, one might have opposed the development, but now that they're built, do we honestly think that those stations shouldn't be busy? Related to that, I'd say, if they're going to be busy, should they be busy with people who are coming into jobs, which are perhaps where there's productivity gains for the city as a whole and so forth? Or should they be busy with tourists, or should they be busy with people, you know, changing at Tottenham Court Road in order to get to Reading? So I actually think if you break it down into specifics, you can have a very, you know, meaningful, objective debate about those components. On the issue of density, I absolutely take the point. It was designed, the analysis was designed to demonstrate that you can have a high number of people working in an area without it looking like Canary Wharf. And secondly, as you saw in the overall projections that we did, we in our good growth scenario to 2041, we only sort of assumed a third of that theoretical number in the projections. Now you'd have to do a lot more work in terms of breaking it down in more detail, but I think it's a useful yardstick to sort of measure, to help people to get comfortable, because they can visualise SoHo, they know what it looks like when we talk about growth. And as I say, I think a third of that overall number is not an overly ambitious aspiration to try and achieve in terms of employment growth in the area. And indeed, we've seen a 25% increase in the last 16 years with not much increase in floor space, in fact, negative floor space growth. On housing, I think that I would argue that two points very quickly. One is, the West End is not going to solve London's housing problem. It's 50,000 people out of 9 million. Having said that, the second point is, given that the private sector at the moment is largely the way in which we produce affordable housing, I think that you can say that there is a narrative which says that if you allow more private sector growth in terms of offices and so forth, you'll then be able to secure more affordable housing. The crucial thing is then how it's configured in order to not then prejudice growth in the future. our good growth scenario, we actually see a mix of housing tenure coming forward rather than in the other growth scenarios where we think there'll be a big push into the just very high end for reasons that I've touched on.
So on the point around, on Ruby's point, you know, does the vagueness of the concept make it politically acceptable? And I think that's quite a sharp point. I think you're right. I think that one of the reasons why people are interested in these concepts about, you know, which reconcile growth and inclusion is that you can sell, you know, it's very hard to be against either of those things. And because of that, it becomes sort of politically pretty useful. I'm actually interested in Silky's view on this, as someone gets to use these concepts on the ground. But the, you know, the danger is that if you have a concept which is which everyone agrees with, it becomes sort of watered down and a bit meaningless. I think there's, you know, I'm very interested to come back in sort of 2-3 years and see what's happened to all these sort of buzzwords around inclusive economy and things like that, and whether they're still around and whether you could trace any actual sort of change from them. So I think that's really, really important. On Josh's point around housing, so I mean, that's also, you know, pretty close to all of our hearts at the moment. I have a massive mortgage and a tiny house. The thing here, thinking, I was just reflecting on sort of on good growth in Alex's presentation, and it's clear that, you know, I thought it was very persuasive, very interesting, saying that you have this notion of good growth and densify parts of the centre and sort of create more jobs. And I think that's, you know, again, that's, it's very hard to be against that. But then part of me is also thinking, well, London's not really got a jobs problem, but we do have a cost problem, and that's mainly a cost problem driven by the sort of housing market. So I guess there's a question there about how you reconcile this sort of densification, sort of development in the centre, how you reconcile that with what happens elsewhere. And I thought, actually, when you were talking about Camden, I thought that was quite interesting. Because if you do think about, you know, if you could densify parts of the centre, then there could be some sort of trickle-down, sort of redistribution effect through the sort of tax rates. One of the interesting things about London, of course, is Westminster is more important. And I think there's a sort of political economy there, which is quite interesting. If you have Westminster, where people are, you know, which is, you know, as you show very clearly, sort of been, you know, the place where a lot of the growth has happened, and there's no sort of, it strikes me, there's relatively little sort of trickle-down effect from growth in Westminster in terms of the tax system, somewhere like Ealing or you know, further north, which is a disadvantage.
I can take the bait and talk a little bit about politics. So I'm always a bit nervous about doing that as an official, because obviously I do work for the government, but I do also work with lots of local councils as well, and so many different political stripes on the whole. And I think if you think about local industrial strategies, which is the stuff I work on, and that objective I mentioned at the beginning about achieving productivity but also ensuring that all communities can contribute to and benefit from the proceeds of prosperity, in certain parts of the country, there are choices that you make, and certainly a Treasury perspective, and maybe Treasury officials here, and we've got one expert in the room. A Treasury view might be, if you take somewhere like Devon, where I'm from, all the kind of major centres of growth are urban in Devon. They are in Exeter, they're in Plymouth, and they're also, if you look to Somerset, they're in Taunton. If you want to benefit the people, the communities in the distant areas, where I'm from in North Devon, then you need to couple your investments in new infrastructure, in high-speed trains joining up the coast with the cities, along, you have to couple with that with your skills system, so that you're training the people up to, in the colleges that are largely pretty neglected, or certainly where I studied was, have a new curriculum that supports the sectors in the urban centres, and you need to transport those people to where those opportunities are. And I think that is largely an approach we are taking in many parts of the country. In London, it is different because we have a different political layer. We have a Labour mayor. And London already performs at 30% higher in city on productivity levels than the rest of the country. So how are you really going to shift the dial? Well, the mayor will say, through social mobility, and that the growth for London is really focused around social mobility and tackling poverty. So then, as an official, we're really, really caught in the mix then of the kind of a Treasury view of the world and the political agency that comes with devolution. It's quite a fun place to be, but I welcome your thoughts on how I advise the minister to reconcile some of those ambitions. Yeah, question.
Your point actually is really interesting, because it does fit with the definition around inclusive growth that comes from UNDP, the World Bank, and the IMF, which I quite like. I like that definition in that they say. down this model of everywhere keeping its own stuff for itself, especially in a whole city like London, it's almost the antithesis of trying to achieve that, not just trickle down, but bringing in of all of the different pockets of deprivation that do exist. One of the things that struck me about Yvonne Charles was Tower Hamlets may well have huge amounts of wealth there, but it's one of also the highly, most deprived areas going in terms of pockets. And it's that narrowing down that seems to me to be what you were talking about in that story.
As an outsider, I feel reluctant to talk about London's growth. I'm from China. Thank you, Professor Li, for the very beginning your comments about China's growth. But it is your comments about China's growth remind me of the London's problem. I'm not sure if I can say that. You can see that? You said that in the past one or two decades, the growth is out of, as you said, two. One is trade, second is technology. And I'm trying to think that, yes, you mentioned that compared with other areas, London's technology is about, you said that about one third, I mean about 30 higher than the rest of the UK. But even that is the case, I think that compared with what happened in China, definitely not too much. As for trade, I think that London must be the one of the most traded areas, even that is the case, taking account of the fact, the Brexit, or the union, I mean, exactly 12 years ago, I was studying in London. I mean, that I was in London, in the UK for 2 years. In those time, the NHS is totally free. But this time, you are, I mean, trying to let all the foreigners pay for themselves. Okay. I'm not sure if that is a way. It's a kind of as of trade problem as well. So my, as I said, another experience, arts car. When I caught this one, I found that I think that my at home, I mean, in Beijing must be exactly this one. So give me a feeling, this is the second time I come to London, and the first month to be here, and I tried my best to find a difference between now and 12 years ago. It's quite difficult for me to find some difference. So my question will be that, yes, I remind you about that. Yes, you were talking about the growth in London. Do we, or do the London really need a kind of growth that China has? Or, I try to find difference, but there's no difference. But I'm not sure if I'm pleased or I'm worried. I mean, that is the question. That, do you think that London needs the kind of growth or keep it?
Okay, thank you. So I think that was about saying, do we want the kind of growth that China has?
I would like to raise a question about growth of London in the context of international competition. So I'd like to ask these our two speakers. So in your opinion, what are the biggest comparative advantage does London have when compared with other metropolitan cities around the world? In other words, how London maintain its international competitiveness? So this is my question.
Great question. Yeah. Alex, you were holding on to a thought from before. Do you have some additional?
Yeah, so only the inequality point. I mean, I think two thoughts, and there's a thread here which I think comes through all the questions, and indeed the whole the dilemma around growth in a way. But I'm very, very sympathetic to the point that as Neil showed, London has higher levels of poverty than other parts, particularly after housing costs. London has more poverty, you know, problems, affordability and poverty problems than many parts of the country. And that kind of gets forgotten. The second thing is that whilst it's absolutely right that in any system there should be fiscal transfers, my concern is that those transfers are too great. That the 30 billion or whatever it is now which leaves London shouldn't be leaving London. It should be a more modest number. And that there should be, Treasury may or may not agree with this, but that there should be an incentive for local authorities, for residents, to be more relaxed or supportive of growth in order to grow the economy as a whole, which will then produce benefits at a national scope. And I just think we've got those. I mean, Westminster collects, I think it gets to keep 6% of the business rates it collects. Mm-hmm. It's, I can't remember exact numbers, someone will correct me. It's something like £1.8 billion or whatever. It's an enormous number. And I just think that you know, this is a very odd way of doing it. And Tony was here, he talked about how it compares to, you know, the other systems internationally and how over centralized ours is. So I think you can have some of your cake, you know, and deal with inequality issues in London, as well as continue for London to continue to contribute to the welfare of the rest of the country. The thing I also just wanted to say was that, you know, in some ways, it may not be, whether or not one's talking about a good growth agenda as such, there is also a sort of a growth, you know, growth is going to happen. It's a bit like sumo wrestling, you know, this force is coming towards us. Now, how can we use, what techniques can we use to maximise the benefit from it? You know, Crossrail will open eventually, and when it does, it will have the potential for 200 million more journeys a year to take place. Do we want those people going to, you may want this, but do we want them going to mass market, sort of nothing against M&M's, but M&M experience type locations, or do we want them, you know, to go to other things? So I think we have to make some choices around the forces and inevitabilities of the way in which the economy works and may indeed continue to evolve. And to the final question, I think, you know, in terms of what gives London its advantage, I mean, books have been written on this, but part of the thing that gives its advantage is the sorts of things that make the West End attractive, which are this mix of different, you know, the name of the characteristics, the mix of offer on that's available. And the risk is that if you restrict growth, you will destroy those things because they'll all be priced out. And that's in addition to, I think, it being a safe city, socially liberal, benefiting from being part of the English-speaking world, time zone in Europe, out of Europe, quite to discuss, you know, English rule of law, and so forth.
So I'm going to start with the last question, which is a really difficult one, and it's difficult because we all agreed no one was going to mention Brexit. And lots of announcements very sort of sneakily sort of got through without mentioning that, because the things which make London great, it's about openness, its scale, it's sort of, you know, it's not so much people like me, it's people from all over the world who come here and sort of make the place. So great, and also its reputation as well, as being an open, you know, forward, thinking place, and I think that's really, really sort of important, and hopefully we'll still have that in a couple of years. On terms of the sort of, you know, do we want the same growth which China has had? I mean, it strikes me probably not, in the same, just because Chinese cities don't seem to be quite as nice as London is, so I would sort of defer to Alex's views. Of, you know,
to be fair, it's a very different transitional growth.
But, I mean, the thing which I think is interesting about particularly sort of Chinese growth is that I have a PhD student who's from a city which is larger than London and which I never heard of. And I think that is partly me being old, not very good at geography lecturer, but it also partly tells you how quickly things are changing and how, you know, how we will need to sort of adapt and sort of, you know, change. And I think we're probably adapting to Chinese growth rather more slowly than we could do. And I just wanted to say, final point around sort of some definitions and what we're thinking about in terms of inclusive growth. And actually, I think the interesting policy question at the moment is the shared prosperity fund. Because one of the things we've been talking about, you know, what replaces the structural funds and how you put in place some sort of regional development funding, which hits this problem, which is that you have places like Tower Hamlets, which are very rich and also very poor. I think there's a really interesting policy question, how you sort of target a fund so that it hits places which are, you know, so that it hits poor people. Or sort of hit poor people, but, you know, so that targets poor people. And so that addresses the problems of poverty in places like London. And it's actually quite hard to do that, and I suspect, you know, people in your team are working on that at the moment.
Yeah, they certainly are, and I think one of the objectives of local industrial strategies is that it influences in a very rigorous evidence-based way across the country how that fund is spent. So lots of places are thinking very, very hard about that inclusive issue for that. That reason. Question at the front here.
Yeah, so I'm going to make a comment following on from Alex and your question, and I will ask a proper question after that. So I'm Mark Lyman, I used to be at this parish a long time ago, and then I spent 10 years at the City Hall. But seriously, the other document to look at, the evidence, economic evidence base, which is produced by the GLA economists, that is a very long document. Mm-hmm. But there's a chapter one or two which does, you know, what is London's competitive position? And I think that can't be beaten. Mm-hmm. And I have nothing to do with that, so that's so on this, the key assets point, I would say it's about deep assets that London has. So one is connectivity, not just we've got an airport, but we've been at the centre of the world economy for like 3 centuries. And you have a deep institutional as well as physical legacy from that. That's really important. Infrastructure is really important. Alex talked a lot about Crossrail 1 and Crossrail 2. So kind of reinvesting, not just relying on the Victorian infrastructure. And thirdly, I'd say it's always been a knowledge economy. So, you know, 1750 or whenever it was, coffee houses, people coming together. You look at those, I used to have a slide of this, but you look at the people talking in the coffee houses, they look like the people in the Google, you know, innovation centers. And they're doing the same stuff. They're basically stealing ideas off each other, stealing labor, persuading people to start a business, most of which will go bust. But, you know, some of them will take off. And it's that which is really deep in the system which gives London an advantage. Then you layer on top of that the time zone advantage, globalization. This is just fortuitous. Mm. We can do business with China and Japan and also with the US and America. English language, which is disappearing as an advantage as everybody begins not just to speak English but to speak very good English, so that disappears a bit, but still there. And then the basics, quality of life, good governance, safety. So, going on to my question, I've got 2 questions. So, one specific question about the West End.
Be quick.
I'll be quick. One is, the thing that was striking, you know, the West End, you're just trying, we're trying to cram too much into it. Why don't we have 2 West Ends? Because what happened with the city was, you know, Canary Wharf took off. Actually, and a lot of people then said, you can't possibly support 2 financial districts in London. It turns out, not only can you, but suddenly the city planning policy changes overnight.
Yeah.
So my kind of question is, why isn't that happening with the kind of retail entertainment culture economy? And the second question, I will finish now, but the assumption all the way through this debate is growth is going to continue. And I just think we need to just ask the question. So we've had 30 years of growth. Before that, 50 years of decline. Sure, touched on. I'm reasonably confident looking out to 2041, you're going to get growth. Once you start thinking about Crossrail 2 and Crossrail 3 and another airport or whatever, you're now looking towards whatever, 2060, 2070. And I just think, I mean, this is something which I'm kind of thinking about a lot at the moment. I just think we need to understand better why the decline turned into growth. We need to have a better theory than we've got at the moment for that, so that we can understand what the future drivers of growth can be, and therefore how to make that growth more inclusive.
Thank you. There's one more question that I must fit in, and then we need to go to the pub in 3 minutes.
I agree with also what Mark said, except the idea that there's any mystery about how it declines or growth. In fact, it declines under growth because the manufacturing sector, which was contracting, everywhere disappeared. In London, the docks disappeared. When we had large scale international immigration, 2 things which we haven't mentioned at all. I think this, a lot of this is a profoundly conservative discussion, deeply worried. It doesn't actually ask, except for Mark recently, some of these disturbing facts about it. So, the period of really dramatic growth in London's employment is from just before the financial crisis until now. Right? It's to some extent a mystery, but to some extent it's something which is driven by massive subsidies which have gone into the financial sector of London. That's one of the things about it. Second thing is that something has happened at the top end of this income distribution in London, not just the bottom end of the distribution. In order to understand the West End, I think I want to know something about hedge funds in the West End as well as in luxury shopping. And I want to know something about the top 1% of earners how much they've contributed to a particular dynamism over this period and how much one might expect that to continue. And the last thing is inclusion. I think the terrible thing about inclusion is we
last comments from you?
So very quickly on the city West End thing. I think that in a way the second West End is happening under our noses, which is the whole Shoreditch thing. The remarkable thing I think about the city's response to Canary Wharf was that, as you rightly say, Mark, the city, historically very conservative about growth in many ways and changing its physical environment, decided to respond to Canary Wharf with growth and to play off the advantages it has over Canary Wharf. And then finally, of course, we all know which way the Jubilee Line went, when arguably it should have gone via the city to Canary, but finally embraced the idea of being connected up in order because the benefit was the whole. The big advantage the city does have, of course, is it has 9,000 residents. So, you know, and indeed Canary Wharf has a similar advantage in terms of its balance. On the growth for granted point, I agree absolutely right. You know, whenever we do these things, I've always said to myself, the infrastructure planning, all this stuff is predicated, it's all continues onwards and upwards. How useful is that to policymakers who need to be thinking about shocks and so forth? I'd like to think that this work does look at scenarios where you do see decline. I mean, I actually gave the soft Brexit analysis there. You should see some of the stuff we did with the hard Brexit. So I absolutely take your point that we should be thinking about the what-ifs more in any of the work that we do.
So I'll just finish with one point just on Mark's point here around, you know, the theory of why growth came back to London. And my favourite thing about that is that growth came back to London certainly before the mayor came back. And I think there's something interesting there because it tells you that actually, you know, local government matters, but there are bigger forces which are sort of shaping the economies of cities. And it might be something to do with them rather than something to do with Ken Livingstone's work, I guess.
Great, thank you. I'll have to leave our questions about what I need to go away and tell the minister to the pub. And there's some feedback form for you to fill in, if that's all right before you leave.